together so they won't see. And so I won't punch anyone else. Violence doesn't seem to have much effect on them anyway.
How the hell could you do that to me?
I ask, my voice furious and hurt.
Lachlan, I thought this was supposed to be a brotherhood, a family of second children. I trusted you with everything about myself. Why couldn't you trust me?
I expect an apology, but he looks at me levelly and says, The underground is bigger than any one person, more important than one night of suffering. We've only known about you for a matter of days, so we know less about you than we typically do about second children. Most we find when they're very young, even babies, or before birth. Our hunting methods are sophisticated, more so than the centers anyway. But we missed you entirely, and only found you by luck. Most second children come here so early they are part of the family. They're loyal. But you...
We don't know where your loyalties lie, Flint supplies. I've been a prisoner all of my life because of center policies, I rage. I've been in constant danger of prison or death. The government killed my mother. Do you really have any doubt about my loyalties at this point?
People can be surprising, even to themselves, Flint says. You don't know what you'd do in the worst situations until they happen to you. But for now, I'm willing to let you into the underground. You're one of us, sister. He offers me his hand. I stare at it, considering. I understand why he did what he did. I really do, in theory. But the fact that he did it to me makes it different. There's a world of difference between what is rationally necessary and what a good person should actually do. Logic shouldn't always win. But my hand rises and clasps his firmly. Something seems to surge through me. Flint is a natural leader, I can tell. Just looking at him makes me feel like he has everything firmly under control. He's inspiring, and I feel like I can rely on him. Sister, I'm no longer alone. But when Lachlan holds his hand out, too, I glare coldly at him and then deliberately look away. We confided in each other. We talked about our lives. He shouldn't have let that happen to me. I understand why Flint did it, and forgive him. But somehow, I can't forgive Lachlan. It might not make perfect sense, but there it is. Come, Flint says, touching me lightly on the shoulder. Let me introduce you to the underground. We exit the torture cave. Just a room now, and step out into something I could never have imagined. I'm inside a jewel. A faceted, glowing, many-hued jewel. Are we still under Eden? I stammer, not believing my eyes. I look out over a huge crystal cavern, maybe half a mile across. The entire roof, and most of the walls of the gigantic cave, are covered with clear, bright, jutting stones that look like colored ice, in subtle, shining shades of palest pink and amethyst. Of smoky silver and water blue and pure clear diamond they surround me, catching the dim artificial light. So beautiful that, just for a second, I don't even notice the more remarkable thing below them. In the center of the twinkling crystal cavern, rising almost to the ceiling and spreading its canopy more than 100 feet across, is a tree. A tree. A living tree. The trunk is massive, 20-30 feet across, lumpy and gnarled. Roots spread above ground for around the trunk before plunging into earth. Earth? Dirt? It can't be. The ground of the cavern looks like a forest floor. Earth covered in brown fallen leaves. My eyes rise to the tree again, and for the first time in my life, I make the gesture they make in temple. My fist rises from my belly to my face. My fingers branch out, like a seed growing, sprouting. I feel reverent awe, like I should fall to my knees, hide my face in the presence of something so radiantly beautiful, so perfect as a tree. Then dawn breaks over the green, living canopy, making the crystals above seem to dance. And tears fall silently from my eyes. It can't be real, I whisper. but I can smell a sharp, sweet scent. Beneath that, something rich and moist. Leaves. And earth. I've never smelled anything like that. No one has. For generations. But some part deep within me recognizes the scents right away. Somewhere in my blood is a memory of nature, and it rejoices. The sky goes from gray to pearl, touched with pink, as the sun breaks an unseen horizon and bathes the world with gentle morning light. That part has to be illusion. Technology. We're deep underground, with rock all around us. Somehow, they've made an almost perfect simulacrum of breaking dawn. But it's not just color or light. I feel a flush of warmth hit my skin from where the sun is rising. The crystals in the roof and the walls shine brightly beautiful. The tree is real, Lachlan says from beside me. I'm so awestruck I don't even think to move away from him. And the earth. But there aren't any more trees. That's what we've been taught. The world is dead. The dirt is toxic. All living things extinct except for a few hardy lichens, single-cell organisms, and a handful of humans. There's one, Lachlan says. But how? Aaron Albaz, of course, Flint says, his voice low and reverent. The man who saved us. The man who will save the world. He made a perfect Eden, and humans corrupted it. We mean to bring Eden back to the paradise he intended it to be. What is this place? The backup Eden, Flint answers. This is where humans would have had to live if Eden wasn't ready in time, or if the world was more toxic than predicted. Underground. He kept it as a secret failsafe in case humans managed to ruin things once again on the surface. It is self-contained and self-perpetuating, set up on computer controls and automation entirely separate from Ecopan. That's amazing, I think. We've been taught that Ecopan took over control of every computer and electronic system on the planet. But he knew man can't live completely apart from nature, Flint went on. So he managed to preserve this tree. The dirt is real organic soil from the surface. Clean, good, uncontaminated pre-fail dirt. It goes down 50 feet, so the roots can bury deep. Hidden panels among the crystals simulate sunlight. As far as the tree knows, it's still on the surface. It gets sunlight, water, nutrients, seasons, and it gives us almost all the oxygen we need to survive down here with the place entirely sealed. He must have loved us, Rowan, to give us all this, Lachlan says. I won't look at him. He must have loved humans so much to save us from ourselves. I have work to do, Flint said abruptly. Lachlan, show her around. I try to protest, but Flint turns on his heel and is gone. Lachlan reaches for my hand, but I shake him off before he can so much as touch me. Every time I look at him, I feel like the wet bag is over my head again, and I'm choking. He steps back and nods, gesturing for me to precede him, giving me space. I want to stay up here gazing at the tree, but then he says, I know you want to touch it. I can't resist that offer. I storm ahead of him, but it's all I can do not to smile. The walls are high, ringed with galleries at multiple levels. I can see many cave-like rooms all around. The interrogation chamber I just left is 4 stories up along the curving walls of the cavernous hall. I fly downstairs cut into the stone, getting curious glances from a few people. I'll look at them later. Just a few days ago, other humans were exciting. But a tree? For the moment, nothing else exists. I sprint across the smooth stone floor until suddenly my feet hit dirt. I skid to a stop and look down at my boots. Lachlan is behind me. Take them off, he urges. And I do, laughing as my bare toes grip the real, natural, packed earth. I touch it with my hands. I kneel. Ecstatically, I kiss it. I must look like an idiot, dirt on my lips, but I don't care. I never thought I'd experience this in my lifetime. Everyone in Eden must endure artificiality for generations, so that one day our descendants might know the glory of nature. I meet Lachlan's eyes, still smiling, and remember my night of torture. My smile dies, and I stand, turning away from him. The tree looms before me, a true behemoth, dwarfing me as I creep closer. I pick up a dead leaf from the litter at my feet, and rub it gently between my fingers, releasing a burst of that sharp, stimulating smell that permeates the air and makes me feel so alert and alive. And then I'm touching the tree, tentatively at first, like a newfound love, then pressing my cheek against the rough, fragrant bark, embracing it. My tears wet the bark, soak into it, and are gone. With my arms wrapped around the huge tree, my chin on the trunk, I look up into the canopy with all its myriad shades of light and dark green. As I look, a leaf detaches from its twig and drifts slowly down, tacking left and right in elegant swoops. I catch it in my hand. Can I keep it? One leaf is more precious than a jewel. I don't care if I hang for it. I slip the leaf beneath my shirt, nestling it close to my heart. It is a gift from the tree to me.
Stop! Look out!
A voice calls from behind me, and I whip around on high alert, ready for green shirts, for anything. Anything, except being under attack from a horde of tiny people in patchwork clothes. I haven't seen children since I was one, and then only Ash. It feels strange to see this pack of screaming, laughing, tiny humans. And I brace myself as they surge toward me, having no idea what they will do. No real comprehension of childish behavior. But they're not running for me. As one, they tackle Lachlan, clinging to his legs, squealing with glee and pretend aggression. And that big, hard man, the one who allowed me to be tortured, is suddenly on the ground beneath a pile of children, laughing, tickling them, letting them put him in headlocks, giving them rides on his back. Which is the real Lachlan? The one who said that torturing me was perfectly fine? Or the one who is currently letting a 4-year-old girl in pigtails pull his hair? He flashes me a quick, almost apologetic smile, before a little boy does a belly flop on his head and brings him down. Lach, they squeal. You're back! We missed you, Lach! What did you bring us? Did you find anyone? Lach, tell us a story of the above. That's quite enough of that, kidlets, says a plump but solid maternal-looking woman as she bustles up behind the children. Let Lachlan breathe. The tiny girl in pigtails looks up at the woman with huge, sincere eyes and says emphatically, But Lach is our favorite! The woman nods. I've heard that before. Perhaps a bit too often. She looks archly at Lachlan as he rises and brushes the dirt from his clothes. And I realize, as the children gaze lovingly at Lachlan, that this is what he did it for. These little second children are the reason he thought it was justifiable to torture a girl who had just lost her mother, who had been hunted through the streets. They need to be protected, at any cost. Now that I understand, I wonder if I would do the same thing myself. I don't know, but I understand why Lachlan did it, and I find that I can't be mad at him anymore. The woman holds out her hand to me. I'm Iris, house mother of the underground. Welcome. I introduce myself, and she tells me to come to her if I need any clothes or personal items. A ruffian like our Lachlan here wouldn't think of creature comforts like lotion and nail files and such. We might be a bit primitive down here, but I like to think we managed to hold on to the best parts of civilization. She gives my shoulder a friendly squeeze and herds the children away. The children all say hello as they pass, making me feel welcome. All except the little girl in pigtails. She shakes my hand very formally and then says, You can like Locke a little, but not too much. He says I'm his favorite girl. Don't you forget. She shakes a warning finger at me and scampers off. I manage to keep a straight face until she's gone. I'll take you to your room, Lachlan says. I know you need to shower and change. Do you have clothes in there? He nods to my backpack. I don't even know. I haven't had a moment to open it. I'll see what I can scrounge up in your size. Thanks, Locke, I say, and he grins sidelong at me as he leads me to my room. Once I'm alone, the bed looks so inviting. I want to flop down on it, curl beneath the crisp new leaf green sheets, and sleep for years. But I'm so filthy, I can't bear to dirty the sheets. So I go into the little shower alcove and let the cold water wash over me, until I'm approximately, if not completely, clean. Being in this room, in the underground itself, it's like being in the heart of the earth. The rooms are carved directly into the stone, and every surface is smooth, connected, without the edges and corners and seams of the rest of Eden. I know the rooms are man-made, not natural caves. But because the material is all natural, it feels almost like the earth made this place for them. For us. I'm part of all this now. Finally, I lie in bed, still damp and cool from my shower, and stare at the ceiling, somewhere between happy and sad and drained. My backpack is on the floor beside me. I know I need to go through it soon, take stock. But I also know that once I delve into the last thing Mom did for me, the sorrow I've kept at bay will return. I will grieve forever, but I know I can't let myself weep forever. So I think about this wonderful, strange place I find myself in. Lachlan said there are about 200 people living here, from infants to elders, all second children. The community has been thriving below ground for about 50 years, ever since a second child rediscovered the hidden world. Even though many of its members venture out into Eden for supplies, it is separate enough that it has developed its own culture. I haven't found out exactly what life is like down here, but I can see the difference even in the clothes. In Eden, styles are brash and sharp, deliberately loud and provocative. Here, colors are a little more muted, more natural. The cut is easy, flowing, and often the material is a beautiful patchwork, made up of complementary fabrics, interspersed with occasional jarring, but oddly fitting, elements that make the whole outfit extraordinary. The effect of the pieced-together motley somehow isn't one of patching and make-do, but of a deliberate choice, taking the best of everything and fitting it together into something even better. Almost everyone I see is wearing a piece of crystal. Most have a simple chunk on a piece of cord around their necks. One pretty young girl has a purple piece at the center of a circlet in her flowing hair. I see one older man with no visible crystal jewelry reach into his pocket and pull out a piece of clear, polished crystal, which he rubs meditatively as he talks to me. I don't see one on Lachlan, but I notice a thin cord around his neck, braided red and orange in a snake-like pattern. Maybe he has a crystal, too. I haven't met anyone beyond Iris and the children, but attitudes here seem so relaxed, so low-key. No one is hurrying to work or entertainment like they do in the inner circles, or hustling in search of money, or away from danger as they do in the outer circles. People down here seem to operate on a different internal clock. No one seems hunted, harried, like they do up in Eden. Everyone up there, now that I think about it, seems caffeinated, driven, a little too sharp. Maybe it's the tree that calms them down, the soothing proximity of nature. Maybe it's a relief to finally be in a place they truly belong. I start to feel it myself, breathing in the leafy scent, feeling the cool cavern air touch my skin. Eventually, I feel centered enough to go through my backpack. The first thing I pull out almost makes me lose it. My ragged, stuffed chimpanzee. Mom must have rescued him from the garbage and stuck him in the pack when I wasn't looking. I hug him tight to my chest, but then set him gently aside. There's one change of clothes, and a pair of soft shoes. A pretty filigree hair ornament Mom often wore. A new sketchbook, and a set of pencils. And in a tightly sealed bag, a notebook. Its pages are made from a substance I don't quite recognize, A plastic of some sort, I think. We use a kind of plastic that is completely recyclable. But I learned in eco-history that people used to use plastics that couldn't easily be broken down, that persisted in the environment forever. Plastics choked entire oceans, and the animals that lived in them. I shudder when I touch it, though I have to admit that such an enduring substance makes a perfect medium for a book. Waterproof, virtually time-proof, whatever is in here will last through the centuries. Written in cramped, awkward hand is a manifesto, or maybe a confession. Sometimes the words are perfectly lucid, textbook clear. In some passages, though, the language rambles incoherently. The handwriting becomes almost illegible, as if the only way the author could squeeze the words out was to scribble them as fast, as unthinkingly as possible. I have a sneaking suspicion who the author might be, even before I turn to the last written page. The page is at the end, and at the middle. That is, the last half of the notebook has been cut out, carved raggedly, hacked even. The scrunched signature has been added in a different ink, at the last remaining page that grips the binding weakly, flapping loosely in the space where the missing pages used to be. I stare at that signature. Aaron Albaz, prophet of environmental doom, founder of Eden, savior of Earth. And if these, his own words, are true, a deluded, psychotic monster. I read through the notebook, and then read it again to be sure I understand. It takes me hours to parse the tale, and when I have, I still can't believe it. Aaron Albaz is a hero, half-god, the whole reason any humans still survive, and the only reason the Earth will one day flourish again after the global devastation we caused. Every textbook says so. Every temple hails him as near divine. I need to tell someone about what I've read, I think at once. But at that very moment, there's a knock on my door, and Lachlan walks in without waiting for an answer. I shove the notebook under the bedclothes and force a friendly smile. It must look pained, but he doesn't say anything. He knows I have plenty to be distraught about. I need more time to digest what I just read. Society is held together by a common belief. What will happen if that belief is shattered? I have to think. The secret has been kept for more than 200 years already. It can keep another hour or two. But I'm numb when Lachlan takes me to meet some of the more prominent members of the underground. There are cooks, clothiers, musicians, storytellers, healers, and even clergy for the underground temple. I've always wanted to go to a temple meeting. Now, everything about the ritual would ring false. No, not everything. Not the message of hope. The desperate need for us to revive and reconnect with the environment. To love and cherish and respect it. But as for the focal point of that worship, the man behind it all. My lip curls involuntarily. I can hardly pay attention to what I'm doing. I forget to smile, forget names, stand dumb like a post. Before I've met everybody, Lachlan makes my apologies. She needs rest, he says, and peace. We'll give her time. Understanding, the beautiful, happy, mellow people go about their lives. They seem ready to accept me, no matter how churlishly I behave. Lachlan leads me back to the roots of the tree. Some of them snake above the ground before plunging into the earth. Soon as I get near the tree, I feel calmer. Do you know what kind of tree this is? Lachlan asks. His voice is soft here. Gentle. There were once thousands of kinds of trees in the world. In my eco-history books, I read about a few of them. Grand oaks, delicate silver birches, maple trees milked for their sweet syrup, fir trees treated with such profligacy that they were chopped down and brought indoors for winter festivals, decorated with lights. But I don't know what this tree is. It's called a camphor tree, Lachlan explains. They grow into giants, as you can see, and the oldest one at the time of the eco-fail was more than 2,000 years old. And that's why I can't say his name. why the creators of the underground chose this species?
Partly. And for the smell.
He inhales deeply.
Think of all our bodies crammed down here. Sealed off from the outside. I don't like to imagine what this place might smell like without the scent of camphor leaves filling the air.
I want to tell him so much, if only to share the burden of knowledge. But I bite my tongue, and he goes on.
The tree has medicinal qualities, too. We don't harvest much, of course, but the oil of camphor can treat lung problems, even some heart problems, in small doses. At larger doses, it is poisonous.
That's interesting, but I still just want to marvel at the fact a tree exists at all. I want to touch it again, to feel its leaves between my fingertips.
But this tree, this one tree out of all the others, is particularly special. It's a symbol of nature's ability to survive, no matter what terrible things humans do. Do you remember in your history class reading about a great conflict called World War II?
I do, vaguely. But in my memory, it merges with all of the other senseless conflicts in our history. Then he refreshes my memory about one part of the war in particular. The time when one group of humans dropped an atomic bomb on another group of humans. Not on a battlefield, even. But on a city full of schoolchildren and mothers and shopkeepers and gardens and playgrounds. The city, the people, the trees were incinerated in a heartbeat. They said nothing could have survived. Nothing would ever grow again. But when spring came, a small number of charred stumps sprang forth with new, green life. Nature had withstood the worst that humans could do at the time.
This tree was grown from a cutting of one of those survivor trees, Lachlan says, touching the bark reverently. A miraculous symbol of nature's regenerative ability. Aaron Albaz hoped, we all hope, that the earth will be as forgiving again. Unfortunately, he adds, humans aren't so forgiving.
His voice hardens.
We make bad choices. We neglect our fellow man.
He looks earnestly at me.
We are all we have left, and yet we make part of our population illegal. I know that supplies will run out if there's uncontrolled reproduction, but can any civilized society actually kill its own children? For any reason? There has to be another way.
He pounds his fist on the bark. I'm a little shocked, but the tree can take it.
There's so much wrong with Eden. So much that can be fixed. We've gotten so far from Aaron Albaz's ideas of kindness and compassion.
I make a choking sound, and he looks at me strangely. I have to tell him.
Rowan, we second children are not just hiding down here. Not just surviving and enduring. We are the children of Eden.
He pauses for a moment while this sinks in.
We're making a plan to take back Eden, and make it a place where everyone is safe. Everyone is equal. Everyone is free. We have allies above.
Like your brother. He nods.
And many others besides. The plight of the second children is small in comparison to the plight of the poor. There are a few hundred of us. There are thousands of the underclasses. The poor. The desperate. You've seen the outer circles. How can there be poverty and crime in the perfect Eden that Aaron Albaz designed? His utopia has been corrupted by power-mad leaders. Albaz would never forgive us for what we've let Eden become.
His voice is low, but deep and reverberating. He seems to stand taller.
Rowan, the revolution is at hand, and we need your help.
I'm so taken aback. I momentarily forget what I just learned from the Albaz Manifesto.
My help? What on earth can I possibly do? You can give me your lenses.
I blink, as if the implants are already in my eyes.
I don't have them yet. But you know where you were going to get them, right? You know the identity of the cybersurgeon.
He is tense and eager, leaning forward as if on the verge of springing for something.
For me? Mom told me where we were headed. I think I could find the place again. Tell me.
And then, I don't know, something makes me hold back. I feel like if I give up this important information, there might not be any more use for me. It feels like a power, almost. Or at the very least, a bargaining chip. My description is vague, misleading, confused. He shakes his head and says he can't think of any place matching that description.
Which circle is it in?
One of the outer ones. I could find it, I offer. I think once I saw the area, Mom's description would come back to me. I could get you there. He looks at me for a long moment, and I'm pretty sure he's aware I'm saying far less than I know. But as long as I'm willing to take him there, he seems content.
Let's go right now, he says. Are you rested enough?
I look at him skeptically. Do you really think it is safe for me to be on the surface again, right away?
And it is daytime, isn't it?
The light panels on the cavern ceiling say so, but my body isn't sure. He sighs.
You're right, of course. I've just been waiting for this chance for so long. Do you know how long we've been searching for a cybersurgeon, skilled enough to make lenses that pass? We've had a lead, just a whisper, about this person you're going to. But we haven't been able to track him down. There's a rumor of someone so skilled they could hack the EcoPan itself, but we have no idea if they really exist. Your parents must have used all their government connections, and plenty of money, to find him and hire him.
I tell him I had no idea it was such a big deal. The way Mom presented it, other second children had gotten black market lenses before.
Some have, he says, but they're not very good. They give the visual appearance of first child eyes, and some can pass a basic identity scan. But no one has ever managed to make lenses that bind fully to the neural network, that are good enough to fool any center official, or security bot, or the EcoPan itself. If the rumor is true, this man can. I need to find him, and get the lenses he has ready for you.
I feel a momentary qualm. My mom gave her life so that I could live like a first child. My only chance of being normal is to have those lenses. And somewhere above my head, a family is waiting to take me in. Is that even still possible? Do the authorities know too much for the original plan to ever work? I bow my head. Of course it could never happen. I have the underground now. It's not what I had planned. But then, what is? Of course I can give up my lenses. And then I realize what this means. And to my shock, I find myself upset.
You mean you're going to have the lenses for yourself?
I ask.
You're going to pass as a first child and live above ground in Eden?
Unspoken are the words, while I stay down here, trapped again. I wouldn't admit it out loud, but already a small part of the appeal of living here in the underground is that Lachlan is a citizen. I don't want him to go.
We have a plan to infiltrate the center at the highest levels. It has been in the works for years, and everything is in place except for the last component, the lenses. Once I have those, there's a place arranged for me with an inner circle family that is deeply sympathetic to our cause. There's a place for me at Oaks Academy.
I give a quick intake of breath. That's the most exclusive school in Eden, just for the children of center officials. Ash goes to a really good school, but Oaks Academy is for the truly elite of Eden.
Believe me, it took every bit of blackmail, bribery, and threats we in the underground possessed to set this up. Flint is going crazy because he's used to taking point on all of our operations. But this is a long-term plan that needs someone to get close to Eden's top families. And there's no way he can do that. And obviously, he's far too old to go to Oaks. But when I get into Oaks Academy with my cover story, I'll be in a perfect position to get at the center, through their sons and daughters.
It makes sense. An adult like Flint can't just appear from nowhere. But a young man, a supposed orphan moving in with relatives, could insinuate himself more easily into that social milieu. Lachlan is charismatic enough to do it, I think. But part of me has been building vague fantasies of friendship here in the underground. And I don't want to lose him this fast. It makes no sense, but I suppose now that I don't have anyone of my own, I'm more prone to cling to the few connections I make. Even if our acquaintance is only a few hours old. I like him, to be truthful. He alternately annoys and enchants me. I want to know him better.
Tomorrow night, after sunset, he says. For now, you can learn more about us, and then get plenty of rest before we set off. I'm nervous about venturing up into Eden again, and anxious about what I've learned about Aaron Albaz. But, before long, I find that the people of the underground have a soothing effect. I feel instantly at ease with all of them. At home, even. The talk ranges from simple, even trivial topics. My favorite foods, curiosity about the latest fashions above ground, to impassioned discussions of politics, equality, and freedom. I'm shy and close-mouthed for a while, but eventually the air of calmness surrounding me allows me to open up. Lachlan comes and goes, checking on me periodically to make sure I'm doing okay. Every time I see him, I want to pull him aside and tell him what I found out about Eden's founder. But every time, he leaves before I can overcome my uncertainty. It's so huge. Blasphemy. But he, and Flint, and all of Eden should know the truth. I'm just talking with an elderly man about deeper caves beneath the Camphor Tree Cavern that might have challenging rock faces to climb, when an alarm pierces my ears. I look around frantically as the deafening noise assaults me, but I can't see any danger. All around me, though, the aura of calm instantly evaporates. Those happy, soft people are all at once hard and focused. Weapons appear from nowhere. People are running here and there, taking up positions, crouching, aiming. "What's happening?" I ask, grabbing Lachlan's arm as he races past. "Get down," is all he has time to say before he races off to a nook in the cavern wall, slings a long rifle over his shoulder, and begins to scale the camphor tree. I still don't see any danger, but the wailing, pulsing sound of the incessant alarm is drilling into my head. I'm not going to stay cowering on the ground. I don't know where to run, so I make a quick decision and follow Lachlan up the tree. Instinct says to climb. He looks surprised to see me following him, but not angry. I wish I had time to enjoy the climb. It's so different from the rock face that it takes me a while to find my rhythm. Near the base, I climb using crevices and knots in the trunk. Higher up, I have to wrap my arms around thick boughs and shimmy. And then higher still, I wrap my legs around limbs and climb with my entire body. It is exhilarating. Exhausting. High in the canopy, not far from the crystal roof, he stops, wedging himself in a crook. He gestures with his eyes to a similar spot a little higher up, and I climb there as he settles himself low against the branch, clinging with his thighs as he props the rifle at an angle, aiming toward the main entrance. I can see the doors easily through the leaves, but anyone on the ground would have a hard time singling me or Lachlan out. He has the perfect sniper position. The underground is primed for battle. But nothing happens. Except that the dreadful alarm finally shuts off. Lachlan holds his position for another 5 minutes, and I bite my lip, waiting. Then there's a second alarm, a softer, repetitive buzz. I see Lachlan's tense shoulders relax. "All clear," he says. "Soon you'll be given your orders for defense drills, but you did well. You kept out of danger, out of the way, and you can act as a spotter from up here. Good job." He slings the rifle back over his shoulder and starts his descent. I follow, and going down is much harder than going up. "You mean there's no real threat? That was just practice?" He pauses in his descent to look up at me. "Make no mistake. The threat is real. The underground is in constant danger." He throws a wry smile up at me. "After all, we're at war." After an early communal supper of simple but delicious food served by the children, trying and failing to look very serious, I go immediately to bed. With the mission to find the cyber surgeon waiting for me the next night, I think I'll have trouble falling asleep so early. On the surface, it would be nearly dark, and down here, the ceiling panels are mimicking a gentle orange sunset that shines through the camphor tree boughs as I wearily make my way to my chamber. I shut the door. It has no lock, which is worrying.
but I suppose there's no danger down here. Except from the outside. The above, as they call it. I fall into bed, expecting to stare sleeplessly at the ceiling. But I must fall asleep almost immediately, because the next thing I know, I'm in another place. Part of me knows it is a dream, but somehow that doesn't make it any less disturbing. I'm walking through a meadow of flowers and tall grass. I can see it. I can smell the green scent that rises as I crush the herbs beneath my feet. It feels completely real. Up ahead I see shapes, low to the ground, and I approach, smiling, thinking they might be animals. The stench hits my nose just before I can make out what they are. Corpses. Human corpses. Scattered across the beautiful meadow, their limbs twisted and contorted, their faces twisted in final agony, and frozen in place until their flesh rots, which it is definitely starting to. The scent of the flowers turns sickly, too sweet, and then dissolves into a smell of blood and decay. At first I can see the grasses beneath the bodies, but as I walk, and because it is a dream, I can't stop walking, can't weep, or run away. The bodies grow thicker on the ground, until it seems as if the earth itself is sprouting them from the dirt. A crop of human corpses. I forge my way through, almost waiting, until the bodies are piled on top of one another, and I have to step high, then climb, and finally crawl up a mountain of bodies. Their rotting flesh sloughs off beneath my fingers as I scramble upward. I can't stop, because there's someone standing atop this mountain of the dead. A tall, slender man with dark hair. A neatly trimmed goatee. I know I have to reach him. He looks down at me, and his eyes are so gentle. How can that be when he's standing on 10,000 corpses? Corpses he made. Because, of course, the man is Aaron Elbaz. He reaches out a hand as if to help me to the summit, but I hold back. He tilts his head, looking at me curiously, and says, "Extinction is natural." This wasn't a natural extinction, I want to say. But in my dream, I'm mute. "Humans evolved to the point where they could wipe themselves off the face of the earth," he says in that soft, reasonable voice. "They would have, eventually. It was just a question of how many other species they took with them. My way was best." Dream Me manages to shake her head. "It was a hard thing to do," he says, a shade of sorrow crossing his face. "But the right thing. You will see, in time." Unable to resist, I reach for his hand. But instead of pulling me up to the summit, he shoves me violently backward, and I'm tumbling, cartwheeling over the pile of bodies, landing in a tangle, trapped in a net of corpses that pull me under like quicksand. I wake up screaming. I'm out of bed and down the hall before I really know if I'm awake or still asleep. No one wakes. No one peers out of their bedrooms. The solid rock must have shielded the sound of my screaming. I could go to Flint. He's the leader. He's responsible for all of these people. And for me now. I should tell him what I know. I could go to Iris, let her take me in her plump maternal arms and comfort me as if I was one of her brood of second children. But instead, I go to Lachlan. I'm drawn to him, irresistibly, in my moment of need. He showed me where his room is, in passing, as he was giving me a tour of the underground. But he didn't invite me in. His room is one of the few occupied dwellings on the upper story of galleries. As I race up the stairs, I realize that if the Eden authorities ever found this place and launched an attack, Lachlan would be first in the line of fire. Of course, he would also be the first one with a clear shot at the invaders. Knowing him, and strangely, I almost feel as if I do, he probably thought of both when picking his room. He would be either a shield or a sacrifice for the vulnerable second children he was defending down below. Whatever was required, he would do. I pound on his door. I don't have the composure for a polite knock. Almost instantly, the door opens a crack, and I see not his face, but the muzzle of his weapon, the glint of his eye barely visible behind it. The first words out of his mouth are, "What's wrong?" He opens the door another inch and looks beyond me for danger. I had a nightmare, I confess. He visibly relaxes, and I wonder if he looks a little disappointed in me. Like he expected me to be able to get through something as trivial as a nightmare on my own. He doesn't realize it is so much more. A nightmare about a terrible truth. He pushes the door open with a sigh.
I'm not sleeping anyway. You might as well come in.
Somehow I expect his room to be stark and ascetic. Bare walls and weapons. But it's like nothing I imagined. Standing racks of clothes are almost decorations in themselves. I realize they're costumes. The disguises he uses to move freely around the city. The bright colors of Inner Circle fashions dominate, muted here and there by various uniforms. Of reclamation workers, delivery men, and other Eden workers who could pass virtually unnoticed. I even see the collection of pieced-together rags that made up his hobo disguise, complete with false hair and beard. But it is the walls that are the most surprising. Every square inch is covered in artwork. Mesmerized, I move closer to look. Most of the pictures are obviously drawn by children. Bold and colorful depictions, mostly of small, grinning little stick people, holding the hand of a tall stick man, obviously meant to represent Lachlan. Without exception, the balloon-headed Lachlans the kids draw wear huge smiles. Though the kids' drawings dominate, there are other more skilled and subtle works, too. One is a simple pencil sketch of an elderly woman sitting in a kitchen, a lump of dough on the table before her. The lines are sparse, but evocative. I can almost smell bread baking. In one corner is the title, Nana. In the other is the artist's name, Iris. I can see Iris's life all in an instant. Raised by a beloved grandmother. Bereft and alone when her grandmother died. And now she's here. Grandmother herself to a huge family. Why did she give this drawing to Lachlan? To remind him that everyone here is family? And then there are a couple of paintings that can only be described as masterful. They're done on rough material, inexpertly mounted, and attached to the rock walls with adhesive. But the skill is astounding. Each picture shows an animal in the center, in a pose that suggests it has no idea anyone is watching. A leopard lolling in indolent magnificence, a squirrel hanging by its hind feet, nibbling a nut held in its forepaws, a dolphin breaching the surface of the foamy sea, just enough to snatch a breath, its eye murky beneath the water. Near the beasts, their environment is depicted in vivid, minute detail. The leopard's jungle is lush and green. The dolphin sea is speckled with sargassum and silver fingerlings. But as the color stretches to the outer edge of the canvas, the detail begins to fade. The richness is diminished. The colors become muted. Their world is vanishing. Suddenly I can see prescience in the animal's eyes. They know their existence is ending. In the right-hand corner, in scratchy black letters, is the artist's name. Lachlan. These are incredible, they say, and I feel like that pat praise sounds insincere. I want to gush about them, about what his paintings make me feel, the autumnal nostalgia for something I never experienced, the loss that happened before my time. But I feel shy, and can't find the words. Lachlan shrugs.
Just something I do in my spare time,
he says, dismissing his own skill.
Not that I have much of that.
I try to explain my reaction to the paintings. They capture that feeling of things slipping away. The inevitability of it. There was a time, I'm sure, when people knew the end was coming, that there was no stopping the eco-fail.
when they still had their cars and air conditioners, and pesticide-laden crops, and could pretend everything would go on like that forever. But they knew the edges of their world were dissolving, and that there was nothing they could do about it anymore. I'm frowning, struggling to express myself. One man could have done something about it, Lachlan says staunchly. Aaron Elbaz tried to stop the man-made catastrophe, and no one would listen. He couldn't stop them from destroying the world, but he could save them. Save us. We have to live up to his memory so we're worthy when we can finally go out into the world. When it heals. He's your hero, isn't he? I ask softly. He's everybody's hero. What if he wasn't? I force myself to ask. Lachlan is fiddling with his weapon, doing something the purpose of which I can't fathom, but it is taking his concentration. He seems to think I'm suggesting something hypothetical, an intellectual exercise and debate. If he wasn't a hero, why were our ancestors all saved in the final human refuge, Eden? He asks absently as he makes a minute adjustment to the sight of his weapon. I make myself speak more firmly. Lachlan, I mean it. What would happen to the people of Eden, of the underground, to you, if you found out that Aaron Elbaz wasn't the good man everyone thinks he is? I have his attention now. His head comes up. His entire body is tense like he just spotted danger. The fact that we're here, when every other animal on the planet is gone, seems to me like proof of his goodness. His voice is challenging, almost antagonistic, and a part of me wants to let the whole thing go. If the people of Eden found out otherwise... He looks confused for a second. He can't conceive of quite what I'm getting at, or what the consequences might be. It would disrupt everything. Everything that everyone believes in. I found something, I say in a small voice. My mother gave it to me before she... I swallow hard. She found it in her house, hidden behind a stone wall. The house belonged to Aaron Elbaz just after the eco-fail. And so I sit down on his bed and tell him what I learned. Aaron Elbaz was a visionary who saw the imminent destruction of the global ecosystem long before anyone else. He was a genius who put technology to work, first to stop the devastation and then, when that proved impossible, to fix it. He made the machines, the computers, the programs, work for him to begin the generations-long process of saving the planet. But before that, he decided to get rid of the thing that had poisoned and burned the planet in the first place. It wasn't the eco-fail that killed off the human species. It was Aaron Elbaz. He did it to save the rest of the planet. It made sense, in a sick, inhumanly logical kind of way. The planet was dying because of people. He could either try to fix the harm the humans had done, or go straight to its source. At some point, the brilliant, mad genius developed a virus that would kill nearly 100% of the population. His talent knew no bounds. He simply created a program that would devise an unstoppable pathogen and let his mechanical minions create it. Then, when the scientists unleashed their particles into the atmosphere in an attempt to reverse global warming, Elbaz released his disease. Of course, he made sure that he himself was immune to it. His family, too. As for the rest of humanity, he left that up to chance. Natural selection, he calls it in his manifesto. He reduced the human population to a fraction of its original billions. Then he gathered up some of the survivors and installed them in Eden to await the day humans could repopulate the world. And the rest of the humans who survived the plague, the ones he didn't take into Eden, they were left to fend for themselves, to die slowly in the dying world, along with all of the other animals. No, Lachlan says flatly when I finish telling him about what I've learned. It is the first word he's spoken throughout the tale. The whole time he sat still and silent on his bed next to me,
almost expressionless except for a slight downward turn of his brow. "But I have proof," I insist, thinking he doesn't believe me. "Aaron Albaz's own admission. I can show you." I start to get up, but he pulls me back down onto the bed. "No," he says again, softly but so firmly. "But..." He holds my hand in his, so I don't even try to raise again. I look down at his knuckles, at the seams of white scars where the skin has been split countless times. So many punches. So much fighting. That has been his life. But he's calm now. Almost unnaturally calm. The only sign of his agitation is the nervous way he strokes my skin with his thumb, over and over again, in the same place.
"Have you told anyone else?"
he asks. I shake my head. "Don't. Please," he adds, and I can see a deep worry in his eyes. "Don't people deserve to know the truth?" He looks down at my hands for a moment, and I wonder what he reads about me there. Short fingernails, ragged now, though clean after my shower. Calloused fingertips from climbing my courtyard wall day in, day out. Split knuckles of my own, fresh and crusted over with a scarlet line. My first battle scar. First of many. I feel like I'm on the cusp of something big, and dangerous, and sublime.
"Aaron Albaz isn't just my hero," Lachlan says. "He's the patron saint of Eden. What we plan to do, the revolution that will make all citizens of Eden free and equal, will be launched in Aaron Albaz's name. He is our touchstone, our inspiration."
"But he was a monster."
"No one knows that," he tells me. "No one can know. It will lead to chaos. That's the last thing we need. The center is doing terrible things, but at least Eden is whole and sound. Water flows, people eat, and the deadly environment outside is kept at bay. We mean to make a smooth transition."
"You said you were at war," I remind him. He nods.
"A subtle war. A battle from within, as bloodless as possible. Do you remember the craters you saw in the outermost rings?"
"I do."
"They're from the last time the Outer Circles staged an uprising. They're from bombs."
I'm shocked, almost more so than I was when I read the truth about Aaron Albaz. "What do you mean? There's never been an uprising. No one ever dropped bombs inside of Eden. It's not in the history books."
"What is in the history books?" he asks sharply. "Ancient history of pre-fail Earth, the life of Albaz, environmental history. But what do the books say about the generations we've lived in Eden?"
I think about it. There are civics books explaining the tenets of Eden. There are books about the governmental system. Lists of previous chancellors and cabinet ministers. But history? Of the years humans have spent in Eden? No. I assume that was because nothing much happened. We simply lived our lives, waiting for the time when we could re-enter the world. It never occurred to me that history could be happening in Eden.
"It's not in the books. And the first children?"
He breaks off, rubbing his forehead.
"It's like they have no memory of it. I've tried to talk with some of our allies about it, and they get confused, or laugh, or flatly deny it." "Craters? They say those must be from collapsed underground water reservoir tanks. But the second children remember. At least the oldest do. And they've passed it on to us."
"It was 70 years ago. The poor of the Outer Circles tried to seize more power for themselves. Armed with stones and staffs and a few guns. Pitifully few. The center retaliated. Brutally." "Why don't the first children remember?"
"I don't know," Lachlan admits. "Some kind of brainwashing? Mutual agreement to ignore the unpleasant parts of life?"
"I have no clue.
But the important part is that we can't square off against the center with weapons and fighters. We'll fail. People will die. And the poor will be worse off than ever. Someone has to infiltrate the center at its core. From there, influence, blackmail. Yes, even violence will be put to work to effect change. In the end,